Benjamin F. Boyd, Julie A. Bright, Appellant Counsel, Richard B. Oldtimer Jr., Brooke H. Spears, Robert W. Lofton, Appellant Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, and good morning. Benjamin Boyd and my co-counsel Julie Grice on behalf of the appellants in this case. This appeal seeks the correct application of basic contract construction principles to determine whether a one-page term sheet is an enforceable agreement. The appellants assert that the term sheet is an unenforceable agreement for the three reasons set forth in the brief. What I want to draw your attention to this morning, Your Honors, is the conduct of the parties after the term sheet was signed, because it, of course, is a big issue in this case whether this term sheet just needed to be set into form or whether the parties intended to hadn't put all the terms into detail and intended to have additional terms added to that agreement. And I think it's clear from the evidence in this case that that is, in fact, the case. Because 1 week after appellee's, after the term sheet was signed, appellant sent to appellee's draft settlement agreements. Now, the term sheet's one page long, and these draft settlement agreements were 5 pages long. And as you know from looking at the record, they contained additional terms and definitions of terms in the term sheet that are certainly material and didn't appear in the term sheet. For instance, that term in the Section 3 of the term sheet at the time Longview is sold, which would trigger the $12 million payment set forth in that section, appellants proposed that that payment would be triggered when 100% of the outstanding shares in Longview were sold. There was also a definition of the proceeds of sale. It was long and complicated and basically put Ms. Lynn in the place of a shareholder of the company, and it also allowed for certain exceptions to be deducted from those proceeds. So none of that appeared in the term sheet. There were other provisions to make the released parties third-party beneficiaries as well. In a nutshell, Your Honor, there was many additional terms and definitions beyond what were set forth in the term sheet. So probably the most important point in this case is, well, what did the appellees do in response to that 5.5-page comprehensive settlement agreement that was contemplated in the term sheet? Did they say, wait a minute, this case is settled, where there's no additional terms, we're going to go forward and you're not going to have the right to do that? No, they did not, Your Honors. Instead, they didn't object to the additional terms, and instead they sent back a redlined agreement. And it's important to look at what they did, again, when you're trying to determine, well, did these parties just want to put this into form, or were there additional terms that they didn't set forth in the term sheet that they planned to negotiate later? So here's what happened. First, they proposed that another party, another defendant below, Mr. Michael Robbins, be added to the comprehensive settlement agreement. So a person that didn't sign the term sheet, they proposed that he be added to the agreement. They proposed specific payments amounts under Section 2, and they also rejected the definition of the sale of Longview that the appellants had proposed. They also rejected the proceeds of sale definition, but they didn't propose a new one. And then, again, very importantly, what they proposed was, whereas the appellants had proposed that the trigger for the sale of Longview would be 100% of the outstanding stock, they proposed that the definition of the sale of Longview, and it's a bit confusing in their draft, but basically they said any sale of stock by Mr. Long, who was the CEO, or Mr. Robbins, who was the CFO, not the company, but these shareholders, if they sold any stock, then, which accounted for at least 10% of the outstanding stock in the company, then that would trigger the sale provision.
Counsel, this is all well and good. It's really interesting. Here's your hurdle. In witness hereof, the undersigned have executed this term sheet intending to be fully bound by its terms. A effective the 9th day of January 2014. Everything that occurred after January 9th, 2014 is interesting in terms of the possibility of further negotiations, in terms of potentially overreaching, maybe in terms of clarifying what's in this two-page document. But, quote, intending to be fully bound by its terms is what we have in front of us.
That's
convince
correct.
Me that doesn't say what I think it says.
No, I think it does say exactly what you've read, Your Honor. And here's what it means in this context. Certainly, Your Honors are always looking at contracts and trying to determine whether parties who might say the same thing in filling out a contract, whether they're bound by those terms. And so you apply contract construction principles to all of those contracts, and sometimes you come to the conclusion that they're not bound by the terms because they weren't certain and complete, there wasn't mutual assent. And so what my point is, Your Honor, is that language does not remove those considerations from this case, and the terms of the case also included that particular provision that they would this would be the basis and the terms would be more fully set forth in the comprehensive settlement agreement. So you still have to go, I believe, to that term and say, well, what did the parties mean there?
The parties can either have no meeting of the minds, a pure agreement to agree, and they didn't intend to make anything that was binding. Or they can have, as was just read, an agreement that they thought they didn't actually intend to agree to do. There was an agreement to agree. They intended to enter into a binding agreement. But it presents to a court in its material terms which are indivisible and non-severable or separable from the rest of the agreement are not definite enough to be enforced. Therefore, it's unenforceable, even though they thought, in fact, subjectively, they had entered into a binding agreement. So there are two completely different concepts. They're related, but the way the briefs were written, it seems like they get mixed together. It seems like you're saying both, but isn't the second prong of your argument the prong that you're really relying on?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree, and that's probably the more narrow grounds to hold that this case, that the term sheet is not enforceable, and that is that there was no mutual assent and that the terms are not certain and complete, because when, of course, you look at the terms in Section 3 in particular, I think that would point to Section 2 as well for the dates issue, but I think it's more certain when you look at the sale provision and the proceeds of sale.
But does a contract have to have terms that are all certain? I mean, can't there be ambiguity in one of the terms, and then you can have parallel evidence, you can have expert testimony about the custom in an industry, whatever. So, I mean, the part that specifically that I'm struggling with, it's not the $3 million, it's the $12 million part. And what does a sale mean? Does that mean the entirety of the stock? Does that mean the assets? Does that mean the customer list, intellectual property, whatever? So in that situation, when you have testimony by the parties, well, in our discussions, this is what we had agreed, and we were going to flesh that out later, as we attempted to do, or have an expert to say, well, a sale of a closely held corporation, this is what that means in industry, and then you have your battle of experts or whatever. Is that the answer, that maybe it's a little uncertain? But, I mean, for example, if the totality of the stock had been sold, that would be a sale. No one would argue it's not, right? But something else, maybe not. So wasn't there an agreement as to sale, and then maybe there would be a hearing to flesh out in a different scenario than what they envisioned if that fell within that term or not?
Well, I agree, Your Honor, that the terms are not certain and complete, the sale and the proceeds of sale term. And so the question then is, do you hold those terms ambiguous? And then, of course, as you've just suggested, you look at the extrinsic evidence in this case to determine whether, not only whether they were certain and complete, you can look at that, but whether there was mutual assent, and that's important in this case, too. Did the parties agree what those terms meant? It either wasn't certain or ambiguous at best, and so we have to look at the evidence. And then that's why I was going through what was said in the draft settlement.
This was something like a 12-hour mediation, right?
So it was.
They were doing a lot of talking.
It was.
So perhaps, at least, there would be some extrinsic evidence to supply some of that.
It was in the record, Your Honor. So both the parties testified to what they understood. And so I read you what was in the settlement agreements that were a week or two after the term sheet was signed, but of course almost 10 months later there was testimony at trial, and the appellees actually testified to a different understanding than what was set forth in the draft agreement that they sent. So in the draft agreement they said, well, if the company or these Mr. Robbins or Mr. Long sell 10% of the stock, that triggers the $12 million. When they got on the stand, they said, no, if you sell one share of stock and it results in a change of control, which again is not defined. There are draft agreements between the parties where they tried to flesh that issue out later.
Did the judge even rule on that aspect of paragraph 3?
No, Your Honor. So what this trial court did was...
So we don't even have that in front of us right now, do we?
What is that, Your Honor?
We don't even have the meaning of paragraph 3 in front of us.
There's no ruling. What the trial court decided to do, Your Honor, was, I'll just say, ignore Section 3. What the trial court confused was determining whether there was a breach of Section 3. Was there a sale? Was the $12 million owed? She said, there's no evidence of that. I'm going to ignore that. But when she did that, she also ignored or excised or severed, I think, as she said, any consideration of mutual assent and certainty and completeness as to Section 3. So,
assuming it was an integrated contract that nonetheless could be separated and each material element would stand on its own for the meaning of the marks.
I agree, Your Honor, that was apparently what she decided, that she could sever this. And as we set forth in the brief, I don't believe, my client asserts that severability really is not germane to this case, because it is, when you look at severability, you assume there's a contract that's been formed between the parties. And so you don't get to the issue of severability until you determine whether there's mutual assent and certainty and completeness in the term sheet.
Well, she also said that the terms of the provision she was enforcing, paragraph 2, are clear and unambiguous. So she's affirmatively not making a finding, factual finding, in full reference with respect to the 4-year period, the beginning dates, the ending dates, how much per quarter, how the payment schedule would work quarterly, etc.
Yeah, I'm not sure I followed, Your Honor, but I agree. She did say Section 2 was clear and unambiguous, but then added terms.
But she'd gone from an ambiguity to extrinsic evidence and then made a factual finding on full evidence. That'd be a different argument.
For Section 2.
Right. But she didn't do that. She said it's clear and unambiguous. Part of the ruling could look at extrinsic evidence.
I agree, Your Honor. And I think on Section 3, she implicitly, if not expressly, said that is ambiguous, even though ultimately she didn't rule on it.
I think what she said was she thought she could sever Section 3 off and not consider it when she's trying to ask whether this is a reportable contract. And the answer is you can do that if it's severable. You can do that if they're obviously interrelated reciprocal provisions, which they obviously are.
I'll reserve the remaining 2 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honor. Rick Holtzheimer on behalf of appellees.
Counsel, if I was sitting as a trial judge, how would I determine what the word sale means?
Your Honor, I think that is a word that doesn't require a definition. This Commonwealth has used the word sale from a simple document that says, I will sell you my farm for $50,000, nothing more. I will sell you this. I will give you
a with a tangible good or a piece of real property, that's one thing, but with a closely held corporation, you could gut the corporation by ceding control, by selling off the intellectual property or whatever. And so isn't it more complicated in that context than your illustration?
It is, and if that was the issue before the court, that there was a sale, we would take that up and we would present evidence.
Right, but the problem is, I mean, this is a single document. And I understand the tail's wagging the dog here, which is the $3 million provision as opposed to the $12 million provision. We're trying to figure out if there's a contract, and we have to look at the thing as a whole and not just laser-like on one thing, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And the court says, well, property is one thing, but the other court that we cited in our brief was the sale of a drugstore, which would be presumably a corporation with stock, with land with leases and things like that. So this court has found that an agreement to sell a drugstore or give a bill of sale was sufficient.
If it's that sufficient, why do you go through multiple iterations after the term sheet is entered, with both parties taking widely variant positions as to what the sale would mean?
And Your Honor, I think that goes to extrinsic evidence. And to address the answer directly, I think both parties were trying to get the best comprehensive agreement possible. But at the end of the day, the core agreements were this term sheet. And in discussions back and forth with counsel, we'd raise something and say, well, that's not in the term sheet. You can't raise that. So we were fighting within the confines of the term sheet.
Term sheet includes a total of 22 lines.
Yes.
It seems rather sparse for a $15 million transaction.
And Your Honor, and that's why we went to court the next day and said, we've settled this case, and I'll get to that on the judicial estoppel, Your Honor, because we knew that we wanted a more formal agreement because it was a large transaction that we thought we wanted to flesh out in a more formal agreement. But at the end of the day, the core agreement was this term sheet. We spent 12 hours kind of negotiating back and forth. This wasn't just something scratched down. This was a document created by Longview's counsel in their office. And again, to the extent there's any ambiguity, it should be read against them. They drafted this agreement at the end of a 12-day session. We had a trial coming up, a multi-week trial. And the counsel talks about, well, we should look at what the parties did after they signed it. What the parties did is they went in the next day to the court and said, we've settled the case. And the judge says, well, I'm not going to take the trial off the docket. I don't do it on agreements to agree. We both told the court it was settled. We gave the court the term sheet.
Can I interrupt you for a second? But the question I asked earlier, there are two different theories here, and they're actually different in a big way. You can say, we never agreed to anything. We agreed to agree in the future, but this term sheet's not an agreement. We had no subjective intent to have a meeting with us. You could also say, actually, no, we did. We thought we settled the case. We thought we had all the material terms nailed down so a court can enforce it. And then a judge say, well, I'm reading your document, and I have no idea what you mean by half the major provisions in this agreement. And so if you want me to rewrite it, fine, but I can't, and I won't. That's indefiniteness. That is subjective meeting of the minds, but the court still objectively won't enforce it because it's too indefinite.
And what the trial judge said is, this issue is not before me. It's not right yet. There is no allegation of sale. There's no belief of sale. So the court did look at the document as a whole and found that the term sheet and specifically Section 2 is sufficient.
Answer me this then. But that point that she made assumes something. And what it assumes, I don't understand. She's assuming she can take an integrated merged agreement that has reciprocal provisions that nobody would have agreed to clause by clause standing alone, that everybody would agree to, it was all packaged together. And she said, I don't need to determine whether or not paragraph 4 is judicially enforceable as indefinite because paragraph 3 is indefinite because paragraph 2 is. That's just a conceptual mistake. She has to determine whether the agreement, if it's integrated and non-severable, can be enforced by the court. If it's a single material term, it can't be. The agreement fails.
And this court has said, in looking at the documents, it is to decide, the judges to decide whether it's integrated or severable.
Okay,
and that's
wrong,
one.
Am I wrong in the way I state things? Because if I am wrong, that cuts me completely off. And what I'm thinking is that integration versus severable point not crucial?
It is, and it's done at the same time.
Okay.
And when the judge looked at it, she reviewed it and thought that it was.
So how is the $12 million exchange not integral to the $3 million exchange? You're going to settle a case and say, well, maybe you have a deal on the 3, but maybe not on the 12. I don't know. Let's just find out.
No, we had a deal, but the $12 million, there was some concern. The reason it was broken up is they may never sell the company. I mean, that was a real risk and possibility.
Well, that's the first question I was asking myself when I read the file. If I were a trial judge and it says at the time Longview is sold, I'd go, when is that going to happen?
And it may never happen. And that was one of the negotiated points because they said this company may not do well. At the time, Sandra Lin was a shareholder and an executive at the company. They terminated her in the underlying case, we allege, without cause, took her shares back. She had no control or role in the company. And there was some thought and discussion about, is this company going to survive? Are they going to take all the money out of it or do something like that? So that was something. So this term number 3 was something that was considered by the parties.
Well, for that point, though, it doesn't seem like it's in your client's best interest to argue that it's severable, get an affirmance on only one provision of the contract, which is the $3 million, not the $12 million, not taking into account that it's a $15 million deal.
But that was what it was appealed. The way it was appealed, there was no appeal of the severability or the ripeness issue. That's the finding of the trial judge. That was not appealed, and that's really not before this court.
If you agree with Justice Kelsey's view of the analysis, then severability has to be a part of this order. I mean, you can't rule on only paragraph 2 and not impliedly rule all the terms are severable.
I would agree with Your Honor.
So your client may end up with $3 million instead of even an argument for $15 million.
Well, and what the trial judge said on that, she said, I'm not getting to that today. So, you know, if that comes up, if it becomes ripe at a later time, there are allegations of the sale, we'll deal with that then, and you may or may not have a claim then, but that's not before her, is what she would do.
And you're okay with that? You're okay with her later saying, you know what, I do not have enough information to interpret clause 3. So therefore, it's indefinite as a matter of law. I'm not going to order anything on 12 million. So instead of getting 15 million, you find it's 3.
She didn't rule that it was indefinite. She just ruled that she didn't review it because it was indefinite.
I'm talking about if we were to agree with you, I just don't know why you don't see yourself going off a cliff later.
We are bound by the court's ruling. We asked the court to enforce the entire thing, to find the entire thing. And we did ask the court whether or not the court found Section 3 binding and ambiguous, and she said, it's just not right, it's not before me, I'm not going to rule on it. So we did try to get that from her. She did not, and we did not appeal that issue. But going to what the court has suggested about all this extrinsic evidence that occurs after the fact, the issue was, is this agreement unambiguous? And everybody had said it was unambiguous. Mr. Boyd, on behalf of Longview, its testimony in Record 382 noted, this is Longview's counsel talking, it's important to note, Your Honor, in this case, that you do not need to hear all this extrinsic evidence that we're about to put on for you. In our opinion, because the contract is clear and unambiguous, and indeed neither party has claimed there's an ambiguity in the contract. Neither party claimed it was ambiguous. The judge never found any ambiguity in this.
How does that not hurt you? Because if it's unambiguous, you don't get the prop of extrinsic evidence for something that we read and can't understand. Therefore, we're limited to reading ambiguous language, arguably, that can't be judicially clarified without rewriting the thing and imposing terms that the parties obviously disputed later. And you don't get the benefit of, well, we can, if it's still enforceable, we kick out the extrinsic evidence, and if you look at that, we get our interpretation.
Well, because we believe that the term sheet is clear on its face. In fact, it's the bold language saying the parties intend to be bound. And we think that makes it absolutely clear as to what the party's intent was in entering into this agreement. And so the trial court didn't find any ambiguity, and Your Honor, for us to be discussing extrinsic evidence here is to be raising ambiguity for the first time in this argument. We don't think that that would be appropriate. And there's a lot of discussion about, well, what's the manifest assent from the parties? What is it? Excuse me, the mutual assent of the parties. What's the mutual assent? Mm-hmm. Your Honor, the standard from this court is, what is the mutual manifest assent? What did the parties manifest their intent to be? And that is this term sheet. So they're talking about, well, look at what's in this agreement. Look what happened afterwards, Your Honor. We don't need to get there when the term sheet says clear on its face, in bold, and as the trial judge noted, when you say something in bold, you really mean it. You want to call attention to it. In bold, it says, executed this term sheet intending to be fully bound by its terms effective this ninth day of January 2014. There's no discussion about it's going to be effective at a later date. It's only going to be effective with a more formal agreement. It is effective immediately. And this court has repeatedly admonished the parties not to discuss secret intents. We don't need to get into the party's secret intent. Maybe both sides had secret intents. We have to look at the manifest intent as shown objectively in this document. And this document says the parties have settled the case, get $3 million, and then there'll be $12 million upon a sale, if it ever occurs. I don't believe that we should get into extrinsic evidence about what happens afterwards. I think to the extent judicial estoppel is an issue before the court, and it was an issue before the trial judge, and she had ruled on this, we can look at what the parties did after the fact. What happened the next day is the parties appeared before the judge and said, we have settled the case, here's our term sheet. There was some discussion about whether or not, well, the judge was told there was an agreement to agree. The trial judge said she did not find that testimony credible. Instead, she said, she found that the trial judge was told that the case was settled, that the term sheet was a binding settlement agreement between the parties. So there was no issue as to, well, we need to define these terms. Both parties knew that the terms here were clear and unambiguous. We told that to the judge, and we received relief, which is clear judicial estoppel. They can't now turn around and say, well, the case isn't settled, the term sheet is not binding. They received judicial relief by representing to a court that the case was settled and the term sheet was binding. Additionally, they also
thought they thought it was settled. Let's assume they actually thought it was settled. But there are terms in the subjectively thought meeting of the minds which are not judicially certain enough to enforce.
But a subjective meeting of the minds is not the test. It is the manifest assent as shown, the manifest mutual assent as shown, and that is the term sheet. And that is the manifest mutual assent that we showed, we gave to the judge and said, it is over, we agree, these are all our terms. Additionally, there was also a counterclaim. They filed a counterclaim claiming that the appellees had breached the term sheet by disclosing the amounts. And I know in the briefs they said, well, we pled in the alternative. As the trial judge noted when that was raised, she said, I don't see anything in the alternative here. You're pleading that the term sheet is binding and that the appellees breached it by filing this lawsuit. And the third opportunity that they had where they went before the court, they received a motion to seal and got the case put under seal. And that basis was the term sheet provides for confidentiality. And the court said, well, they argued with the court, and we said, obviously, that we thought it was an appropriate foot seal, but they said, that's what was agreed to, it's binding, and they received that relief. Now, what happened later, they did non-suit the counterclaim because that did put them in a bad position. They also, under pressure from Judge Nordman, who the trial judge who issued this order, agreed to unseal the case. She said, you're coming here before me on a trial as to whether the term sheet is binding on you, and yet you also at the same time have this under seal by saying that the term sheet requires it to be under seal. And under pressure, Longview did agree to unseal the case because it was, honestly, they were judicially estopped. They have represented to the, they can't at one hand say, this is a binding agreement, please give us a counterclaim, please give us confidentiality, and then on the other hand, defend the lawsuit saying it's not binding. So we have three instances where the court found judicial estoppel, and for them to believe in their briefs have said, well, the court never found it, the court did. And if this court looks at the judge's opinion, she specifically went through her findings of fact that led up to her finding of breach of contract, and she specifically went through the elements of judicial estoppel and specifically focused on the representations that were made to the judge in the underlying case that the case was settled. She says, I find it incredible, and I would find that the judge only removed the case from the docket based upon representations of the party that the case was settled. And finally, with respect to just briefly on the start dates, this court has noted in McDaniel versus Davies and Young versus Ellis that agreements don't need to have specific dates for payments. That is something that the courts can fill in. And here, especially when there's a period of time like a year or a quarter, the start date will begin at the end of that quarter. The trial judge had ruled on that. She said it was April 9th. I think their allegations are that it should be earlier. Obviously, April 1st or something like that, saying that's the beginning of the next quarter. We think that would be harmless error. And there's no further questions.
Rebuttal, you have 2 minutes and 7 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just a few points. In regard to the Section 3, there was a claim for breach. If you look back at the complaint, that they said there was a sale that occurred. They ultimately didn't put in on any evidence that a sale occurred, but when you read the complaint, that was before the judge. There was a request for a declaration as well as to the enforceability of the contract as a whole. In regard to this judicial estoppel argument, again, I would ask you to look closely at the record. There's no ruling here on judicial estoppel. They didn't object to the lack of a ruling, so there's nothing there. And again, as we set forth in our brief, there is a misdirection here. They're trying to estop a legal argument. They want to say you can't argue that the contract's unenforceable, but judicial estoppel, of course, applies to facts. And generally, it applies to facts found in one proceeding where the party said X, and then they're in a second proceeding and they're trying to say Y, And then the courts say, you know, you can't do that. You can't try to switch things. Finally, Your Honor, I'll ask you to look closely. I believe it's at appendix page 500 through about 505, where there's the testimony of counsel regarding that meeting with the judge. And yes, the trial court did find that the parties, with hope in their heart, told the judge that it was settled. But they also showed him the term sheet. They also said that this was a continuance for settlement and that they had to negotiate another agreement. So for all these reasons, we request that the trial court's ruling be vacated, that judgment be entered in favor of the appellants. Thank you.